Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. In the midst of the pandemic, it's particularly hard to be the official opposition in the federal government. With all the attention focused on the government's actions in dealing with COVID-19, people are not paying attention to much else. For Northumberland Peterborough South MP Philip Lawrence, there is a lot to keep him busy. In an interview today, you will hear exactly what he's been doing over the past 6 months since we last spoke, as well as getting an idea of what to expect in 2021. Here is my interview with Northumberland Peterborough South MP Philip Lawrence. I'm so pleased to have with me today Philip Lawrence, MP for Northumberland Peterborough South. Welcome to Consider This.
Thank you, and I'm always pleased to be here. It's great to spend time with you, Rob.
Thank you. The last time we spoke, Erin O'Toole had just won the party leadership back in August. How would you rate the job he's done since then?
Oh, I think Erin's done a fantastic job. I think he's been able to communicate the fact that we need to have more people look in the mirror, and they need to see a conservative looking back at them, right? And broadening our tent. Our voter ceiling, I don't think it's a secret, Rob, has been lower than what we would like it to be. And so in reaching out and making our tent a little bit bigger and getting people from different perspectives and different backgrounds to join our cause for individual liberty and freedom, I think he's done a fantastic job.
Can you give me some specific examples of the kinds of things that he's doing and the type of people that he's bringing in?
Yeah. So he's had an outreach. Like, it's been difficult for all of us, especially for a new leader, but he's had calls literally from coast to coast to coast. He's had entire days in Zoom and in Quebec particularly, I might point out, we seem to have an uptick in support in Quebec. And of course, during his leadership race, he dominated Quebec. We've got some great people on the ground, and I think Quebecers are naturally conservative voters. And so we just need to present the argument.
Now, back in September, you were named as the Shadow Minister for National Revenue. What does that job entail?
Yeah, so the way you can sort of look at it, if you get it right down to brass tacks, is we're the critic for the Canada Revenue Agency, right? So it's not exactly the worst position in the world, Rob, because there aren't a huge amount of people who are fans of the CRA out there. But in all respect, I should say that the folks at the CRA work very hard, and especially during the pandemic, they did a fantastic job in terms of getting money out the door quickly to Canadians. Many of the civil servants worked around the clock. But where there are issues, it's my job to point it out as a constructive opposition and say, hey, we can do better. So it was actually my great privilege and honor, Rob, to be one of the co-sponsors of a Opposition Day motion. We only had four this year, and for myself as a fairly new shadow cabinet minister to be one of the co-sponsors of it, and that was with respect to the wage subsidy. So for your listeners who don't know, the CRA decided to audit the wage subsidy, and particularly small business owners. And we said, you know what? We respect that. That's a good idea, but just not now, not during the second wave of a pandemic, because these audits aren't like an individual audit where you might bring your T4 and maybe your babysitting slips and relatively small. These would incur like thousands of dollars in professional fees, hundreds of papers being prepared. It just wasn't the right time. And so the CRA actually backed down, Rob. And so we were able to get a victory there. So that was one of the highlights for me in 2020.
I also know at the same time, though, did you not, were not critical also of the CERB program and the number of repayments in the CERB program? I know you stood in the House and spoke on this as well.
Yeah, so that's a great question. What we need to do is clarify, though. What I was critical of the CRA is the way they communicated the CERB benefits. Particularly, there's now a controversy, Rob, between gross and net income for small business owners. The CRA has come out and said, we weren't clear. We weren't clear. The government has come out and said, we weren't clear. And that's a big deal, because that meant a lot of people, a lot of small business owners. And those aren't these aren't the folks who necessarily own like the home hardwares and larger. These are folks who are artists who maybe have a small fledgling new business. These are sole proprietors. And so they were told more or less, yeah, go ahead and apply for the CERB. And then they got a letter saying, well, no, you weren't supposed to get it, which put in a very challenging situation. So we to be clear, Rob, we want everyone who was entitled to the CERB to get the CERB. But where the government made mistakes in communicating it, we believe that they should own up to that as well.
But I also noticed, too, even in another interview you did at the year end, you were talking about how in opposition you had asked the Prime Minister to expand the benefit back in March from 10% up to 75% for wage subsidies. And yet I was looking through and I couldn't find any place where the credit went to the opposition. In fact, I saw that there were various business groups. I think the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, the United Steelworkers, Canadian Business Council of Canada, Canadian Chamber of Commerce, all of those were very, very vocal back in March about this program, the fact that they were only going to offer up to 10%. And then after this wave of a protest, they raised it to 75%. Where did you guys fit into that? Because I couldn't see where your opposition came.
Yeah, we were right at the outset. I don't know, and I couldn't source it right now, but if you gave me some time, Rob, I certainly could. It's been a bit of a blur of a year, but we were right out from the outset, and we supported the 75%, and I can remember actually being on Mark Rockburn's show and talking about that early on, about the fact that it needed to be 75%. So that was right early on, and I'm sure I could source that and find that for you. But we definitely believed, like during the early days of the pandemic, that we needed to get the wage subsidy out there quicker, because the wage subsidy, the CERB, we certainly supported that program and we're on record from supporting from the beginning. But if given our druthers, and I think 99% of Canadians, would you rather have your job protected with the wage subsidy where you can continue in an employment situation, or would you rather have that job disappear and go on to the CERB? Most would prefer the wage subsidy as opposed to having their employment terminated. So if we were going back again, we would say do the same thing with the CERB, except for you miscommunicated. You didn't do a great job of communicating. You did do a great job of getting it out the door quick, but get the wage subsidy out as quick, if not quicker, so we can protect as many jobs as we can.
It seems understandable. I mean, in those early days, I think we were all a bit scrambled and everyone was, you know, trying to move quickly so that the economy didn't come off the rails completely. Would you agree with that?
100%, Rob. And I've been on record. I will be critical, and that's our job, but I want to be constructive as well. And it only makes sense. Like, this was a once in a generation pandemic. And so for the first 6 weeks, especially, like no one knew exactly how to handle this situation. I get that. I'm clear. Where some of my stronger criticism comes is now a year into the pandemic, we haven't gotten some things right. Right, like we haven't gotten rapid testing right. The vaccines appear to be slowly to come out. It took them 8 months to get the rent subsidy right. But I am more than forgiving for especially the first part of the pandemic. I think it'd be unfair to hold the government to say that they should have gotten everything in the right first day of the pandemic.
Why is your party so critical, though, of the way that things are rolling out right now with the vaccine? I mean, again, this is all new to us. You know, when has there ever been a time in modern memory where we've had to roll out this level of medical help to people? How is it constructive then to turn around and be critical of something like this, especially when people are all the circumstances and the way things are going?
Yeah, we want to be constructive, as I said. We want to have meaningful solutions that help Canadians. It just and you're right, Rob. This is a once in a generation time of rolling out this massive vaccine, and I get that, and I want to be clear on that. But when we look across other jurisdictions in the world, it appears, and still early days, Rob, it appears we're falling behind, right? It appears as though the United States has more access to vaccines than we do. It appears as though the United Kingdom has more access and earlier access and a more robust vaccine rollout plan. And so why, well, this is a once in a generation, there are other examples, and we do appear to not be in the top 10% or the top 15% or even the top 20% of developed nations.
Do you think, though, it might be related to the fact that in Canada we don't have a very strong pharmaceutical manufacturing sector?
So there was a great article actually published by one of Canada's leading epidemiologists, and he said no, that's not the case. He said that actually Canadians that's not true. What we could point to is the fact that that China, Sino, and Canada went on to a vaccine program together that fell apart, and we put a lot of our eggs in that basket, and then we were forced to scramble. The part of that that is a bit frustrating, if I can say, from the governments in their talking points is with respect to the fact they keep talking about their large portfolio of vaccinations. Well, it doesn't matter if every Canadian has 10 vaccinations if they don't get out in time. The key is, do we have the amount of vaccinations we need to give every Canadian who wants it a vaccine as soon as possible? And like I said, the empirical evidence appears, still early days, that we're behind many other countries in the world, and we need to stop that.
You have introduced a private member's bill to expand Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act to include marketable natural gas and propane. Can you explain to those of us who may not fully understand what that means, why that's significant and why you did it?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's specifically to help our farmers. As you're probably well aware, agriculture is one of the largest drivers in Canada, and also, just as importantly, one of the largest drivers of our economy right here in Northumberland, Peterborough South. So underneath the current Greenhouse Gas Pollution Act, farmers are exempt with respect to diesel, which is called colored fuel, and gasoline. Okay. In other jurisdictions, such as British Columbia, the carbon tax, there was given an exemption not only for farmers for diesel and natural gas, but also to propane as well. And the reason why natural gas and propane, gas and diesel, we're adding natural gas and propane. That's the way it's done in most other jurisdictions, including British Columbia. We don't know. It might have just been an oversight by the government. But the idea of the carbon tax, or at least the way that the Liberal government has presented it, is supposed to be revenue neutral. It's supposed to change your behavior, but not cost you any money. With respect to farmers, they've shown me bills that are tens of thousands of dollars, Rob, clearly not revenue neutral. Our farmers have struggled over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years with low grain prices, with other issues. And so we wanted to extend this exemption. And you know what? Candidly, this we'll fight the carbon tax another day, but this isn't a bill necessarily against the carbon tax. It's just in some ways it actually strengthens this legislation because it's an exemption that makes it makes the legislation make more sense. That doesn't disproportionately hurt farmers, and that's why actually we have the NDP support, the Bloc Québécois potential support, and I've even a Green Party member has also indicated support. So this isn't really about fighting the carbon tax. This is about taking legislation that's disproportionately hurting our farmers and fixing it.
Well, it's interesting because in June, the federal minister said her department had calculated the average cost of carbon tax on grain drying, which is what you're talking about, is they use the propane to dry the crops. And she said in 2019, it was between $200 and $800 per farm, and not the tens of thousands of dollars you're talking about. How do you respond to her comments?
Yeah, so we've got from the Saskatchewan, from the Manitoba, from various other wheat-producing grain growers associations that shows that her numbers just aren't right. In addition to that, the PBO, which is a nonpartisan organization, said that my exemption will save farmers about $60 million over the next 5 years. So I don't know where she's getting her numbers from, but from the organizations, including the CFIB, numerous grain grower organizations across this country, and from the Parliamentary Budgetary Office, they would all point to the fact that this exemption, that right now the carbon tax is very much disproportionately hurting farmers.
It's well known that private member bills often die in the House for obvious reasons. I'm wondering just where are you at with this, and how successful do you think you're going to be?
Yeah. So I'm in a strange position, Rob. I don't want an election. I don't think now is the right time for the election. I think we need to get through the wave and through the second wave of COVID, get people vaccinated. We can look to an election after with that. In addition to that, I want to keep the government intact for my private members bill, because actually we're working right the way through. We've gone through the first reading, we've done a second reading, we're going to go to committee now, and then we'll go back for a third reading and eventual vote, and we've got support of the NDP in the Bloc, and even some Liberal members have shown some tacit support, including Wayne Easter in the House had some very positive comments in there. So everything is looking great. The only thing that I could see right now, it's politics, so anything can happen, as you know, Rob. But the only way that I see my private members bill not becoming legislation is if the government falls.
Now, back in August, you toured Coburg's downtown. And during that visit, you were told that the town could apply for and pass along a federal program. Could you refresh our memories about that federal program? And did you follow up with the town as to why they did not apply?
There are lots of federal programs, Rob.
Pardon me. In the article, it talked about a federal program. One of the business people, they weren't specific at all. They just said that there was this federal program that the town could pass along, and you agreed. And then I just wondered, had there been any follow-up to that, those conversations when you did that tour?
I apologize. I'm not necessarily placing that. There's a ton of different programs. Okay. I apologize, Rob.
All right.
I'd have to look back at that conversation
right
there.
Fair enough.
My memory's good. It's just short.
No, it's all right. I feel your pain. By the way, you did mention in that article as well that you were going to go back to Brockeneers and buy a suit. Did you do that?
I did. It took me a little bit longer to, in full disclosure to everyone. But I believe probably in November or so, I went to Brockeneers and bought a fabulous suit. And actually, I must say, I think it is the nicest suit I've ever owned. They did a fantastic job there. So we're in the lockdown now, but as soon as the lockdown is over, please do go down to Brockeneers. You'll never find a better suit.
Well, I hope your regular tailor's not listening. you spoke in the House of Commons recently about your support for Bill C-8 to amend the Citizenship Act.
Yes.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the C-8 is a very important piece of legislation. It comes from the Truth and Reconciliation. I think it was recommendation number 93, if I'm not incorrect. And that is to include the treaty rights as well as Indigenous people in the citizenship oath. So it says, as a newcomer coming to Canada, they enter into Canada. One of the very first things that they will do is swear an oath that includes their Indigenous peoples. As we walk the walk of reconciliation, I think this is one of those steps. It's relatively a small step compared to some of the other recommendations in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it's another step along there, and I was very proud to support it. And actually, that was one of one of my most important, and I think if I could be so bold, is one of my best speeches in recounting some of the atrocities that the Indigenous people have felt from women not being necessarily protected the way they should be with respect to Indigenous missing women, and the residential schools where small children were literally plucked from their homes and forced to give up everything that they know. So I was very proud to give that speech.
Well, you did speak at great length about your opposition to the treatment of Indigenous people. You mentioned Alderville and Hiawatha. You also said you were appalled by the lack of clean drinking water, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, abuse, residential schools. Now, many governments led by both Liberals and Conservatives have done little or nothing to resolve these and a host of other Indigenous issues. So what is your party prepared to do on these issues, especially in light of the recent comments by your party leader that he had to walk back earlier this month?
Yeah, and Aaron did apologize for those comments, and I know Aaron, and I know that he is a supporter of Indigenous peoples across our lands, and is more than aware of the atrocities and the challenges that the Indigenous people have felt. We'll certainly have our policy items coming out from that, but what I can speak from my heart as a representative of both the Hiawatha Nations, First Nations, as well as Alderville, that it is at the very top of my list of priorities to walk the walk of reconciliation, to make sure that every Indigenous child has an opportunity to be successful in this great country. It's a black mark on our country. It's a tragedy that this has occurred, and it's one of the highest responsibilities I take, being the representative from Northumberland, Peterborough South, to make sure that the people of Alderville and of Hiawatha feel as though they're being represented well in Ottawa.
How do you feel about cancel culture?
Give me a little more on that, Rob.
Cancel culture being things like, he was speaking to the Ryerson students. There was a talk about changing the name of Ryerson because of the name and being associated with the residential school system. And these types of things, yeah. I mean, the same came up with Port Hope and the statue out in front of Port Hope to remove it. This is what is called, I believe, mainstream as cancel culture. And I just wondered how you feel about that, because that's what he was speaking to at the time.
Yeah, I think we have to weigh both sides of this, right? I think we have to, part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was, you know, we can't just shut our eyes to our history, right? That's the last thing we want to do from either side of the argument. And so we have to enter these things with our eyes wide open and say, you know what, we were responsible for and like you said, a conservative, liberal, whatever the government, we were responsible for the residential schools. We own that. And now part of it is acknowledging that truth and then moving forward from it. Does that mean that we should abolish all of Canadian history? I don't think so. There were also many great achievements by Canadians in the past, and there were many great prime ministers. Pierre Elliott Trudeau, I mean, certainly was responsible for furthering the residential schools. But on the other hand, he also brought us the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a major victory for democracy. So it's important for us not to look at the truth, look at what actually happened, discuss it, be open, be adult about it, and to where Canada failed, acknowledge that and try to make it better. Where Canada was successful, also to acknowledge and recognize that.
Do you think that Colonel Williams' statue out in front of Port Hope Town Hall should come down?
To be honest, Rob, I'll be real frank with you. That's something I would I'd love to discuss with people from all sides. I just am not in a position to take a position at this point. But I would certainly I'd like to have a discussion with stakeholders from all sides here.
Now, you've spoken a number of times in the House on medically assisted dying.
Yes.
Could you outline your position and why you are taking it?
Yeah, so that was one of the most difficult votes that I've had so far, I would say, and a very challenging issue. And I think it's incredibly important to acknowledge that the reasonability of the positions on all sides of the House and all sides of Canadians on that. I have great supporters of mine who are great supporters of medical assistance in dying, and I also have great supporters who are against medical assistance in dying. Now, where I came down on this was the law is the law. It's from the Supreme Court decision. Medical assisted dying is part of the fabric of Canada, and probably is not changing for the foreseeable future. The challenge with the legislation that was put in front of us is that it discriminated against people with disabilities. People with disabilities were able to get immediate access to MAID based on mental health issues, which can mean that you have a permanent solution to a temporary problem. That's not the same for people who aren't with disabilities. And so one of the things I said from my very first debate, and I think if you look back at our first interview, it's probably in there as well, is that I'm here to protect the most vulnerable. I think that it's a sacrosanct responsibility of all members of Parliament. So with that in place, I had to vote against it to protect people with disabilities. And I'm not alone in that. Jody Wilson-Raybould, who actually wrote C-14, which was Canada's first medical assistance in dying legislation, voted against MAID. So did the one of the few doctors in the Liberal caucus as well, because they believe that while we could support MAID in certain circumstances, the way that this legislation was drafted was not correct. And that's what 72 out of the 72 Disability Advocate Association said. So like I said, I fully respect people. And I can tell you, Rob, with a different bill, I might have been in a position to support it, but this legislation was flawed.
You often talk about small business in the House. And what would you be doing differently compared to what is being done now to save small business during this pandemic?
Yeah. So as we talked about, Rob, and we have to live in the real world in this. And so I can't just say, you know what, if I were in government, I'd snap my fingers and everyone have vaccines and everything would be back to business tomorrow. I get that. I want to be clear and fair with the government on that. But one of the key things is we have to get people safely, most importantly, safely back to work. And how I define that would be getting the vaccines out as quickly as possible. As I said, if you look across G7 nations, we appear to be falling behind. The second part is that it would be rapid testing, that they almost worked hand in hand so that we can get people back to work quicker. And so we need to have rapid testing available to Canadians. I was talking to, and I can't say the name of the business, but a major business owner here in Northumberland, Peterborough South, just this week. And their business has been greatly reduced because of the lockdown. They want access to at-home rapid tests. And they, unfortunately, they are not allowed by Health Canada. And so these are the types of examples where we ultimately, the solution will be getting businesses back to work through vaccines and rapid tests. Also in the interim, we shouldn't be raising taxes. So the Liberals have unfortunately raised taxes. They've raised taxes on alcohol. They've announced that they're going to triple the carbon tax. They've already raised both those taxes, by the way. They're also going to increase taxes on Netflix as well. So no country has ever taxed themselves into prosperity. It just doesn't work that way. We need to reduce the burden on small business owners, and we need to clear the field for them so that they can be successful. So thank you for the question. It's something I feel very passionate about.
But how do we balance this all out? Because obviously the government is going into huge amounts of debt to cover all these costs. They've got to find some sources of revenue. And then if they don't, they find themselves then in an election or in any sort of debate, trying to defend the fact that there's going to be this huge debt coming out the other side. And how do we drive ourselves so deeply into debt? You were irresponsible. You could have raised a few taxes just to try and at least stem the tide. I mean, doesn't that sound like a reasonable strategy going in?
No, there had to be some spending. The challenge, there had to be. Like, we've supported the CERB, we supported the Canadian wage subsidy. So the trouble is that only accounts for about half of the pandemic spending. And so we've also seen money wasted, such as that money put towards the WE scandal. So we need to reduce that. And with respect to the debt and deficit, I think it would be unreasonable to say that any government would not have run a deficit in 2020. The question now, though, is how do we get out of it? And so I've been calling for at least 3 months, maybe 6 months now, a fiscal anchor. Like, tell us what your plan is to get out in debt and deficit. And that's part of getting small business and business in general in Canada being successful, because for capital investment to flow in here, for our in order for money to come to Canada to support our small businesses and our businesses really across the spectrum, we need to have a financial sustainability program. And we've already had one downgrade, Rob, and the analysts across the world are now saying to us, okay, you've run the debt and deficit, you had to support your people, we get that, but what's the plan to get out of here? How are we getting back to financial sustainability? And it's troublesome. It really is troublesome that the finance minister won't commit to any type of financial anchor. And for those of you who don't know what a financial anchor is, I'm sure most do, but it can be a balance balanced budget. You can say a balanced budget in 20 years. It can be a debt to GDP ratio, right? We're only going to have a percentage, so much of debt to ratio. But something, some path, you can just think of it at your house, right? So you're racking up credit cards because you lost your job. Well, okay, I realize that we've lost our job, but what's our plan? We can't keep doing this forever. How are we going to get out of this? And the Minister of Finance won't give us that. So,
but isn't it? I mean, one of the hallmarks of 2020 has been a sense of uncertainty of the future. So, isn't it sort of counterintuitive to expect somebody to have a plan going forward when so much is still uncertain? I mean, we are starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel, but we don't know how long that tunnel is. And what is that light? Is it an oncoming train or is it actually daylight? So, you know, how do you compensate for that, though, in your argument?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll go to, as all politicians do, quote Winston Churchill. And so what Winston Churchill said, during, I believe it was during World War II, and there's a lot of things in flux in World War II. What he said is that, you know what, is a plan may be useless, but planning is invaluable, right? And so if, in fact, the Minister of Finance, Minister Freeland, comes out and says, you know what, we want to have a balanced budget by 2030, and you know what, the world, we get the third wave or the fourth wave or this UK COVID pandemic or UK COVID that is a strain that is new and more transferable, comes to Canada in large force and it creates, that's fine. We will not hold her to account. You have my word on that if the world changes. But by not having any type of plan, it leaves us open as was once said by Lewis Carroll, you know what, if you don't have a destination, any road will do, which is scary.
But what has it been like to debate in Parliament virtually?
You know what, it's an odd feeling, right? Because when you're in the House, you get the vibe, right? And so, like, are the opposition liking what you're saying? Are your colleagues liking what they say? And you feel that energy, right? And so I especially, now being in there for a year, often will go without notes. And so if, in fact, I'm feeling that this is something that needs to be explored more, that the sort of the will of the room is, and I will go and talk more about that, right? Whereas if I think I'm losing the crowd, as it were, I will get it relatively short. On doing this, like, I have no way of sort of seeing, well, is this something that people are actually interested in or not? And I find that a little bit cold, but I find my speeches are probably a little bit more proper in their sentence, in the way that they're laid out, but they're not as much fun, and they're not candidly as energetic, right? Because you get that energy from being in the House, right?
What are your plans for 2021?
So anything specific there, or just you want to just go? Okay. Sounds good. Yeah. So number one is always to represent the people of Northumberland, Peterborough South. So I am hopeful. I am hopeful that we will get the vaccine out, and so that I will be able to go out and see and talk to people. I think nearly every politician, if you ask them what's their favorite part of their job, it's going out and talking to people. That's what I'm looking forward to. So looking forward to bringing those discussions back. Secondly, is I want to do a great job for Aaron and for the country as a shadow cabinet minister for national revenue and holding a CRA account and being that constructive opposition fighting for the taxpayers of Canada. Third would be to get my private members bill if we can get that through.
Philip Lawrence, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today, and have a very happy new year.
Yeah, you too. And I wish everyone out there a happy new year. I've got a sneaking suspicion, Rob. I've got a sneaking suspicion that 2021 will be one of the greatest years in Canada's history. And I am looking forward to just a spectacular rebound from COVID-19 and Canada leading the way.
Well, we'll look forward to talking to you then.
All right. Thank you, sir.
I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me. And I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca.
There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.